This is the podcast of AK from the Alaska Public Radio Network. AK is a weekly show that presents the stories and sounds of Alaska's characters, cultures, and current events. AK is made possible by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alaska Humanities Forum.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechemir.
From the frozen North Slope to soggy Southeast, from the Kuskokwim Delta to the upper Yukon River, from the far reaches of the Aleutian Chain to the heart of the interior, this is AK. This week on AK, Get Thrifty. We'll take a look at one community's controversial effort to produce cheaper power and meet a man eking out an existence living in his RV for the winter. Plus, moving to Anchorage for the cost savings.
Anchorage just nickels and dimes you. There's just so much more that gets figured into the budget that it just nickels and dimes you.
All that and more coming up on AK from APRN. Welcome to AK. I'm Ellen Lockyer. It seems everyone is tightening the belt these days, a trend directly linked to this fall's Wall Street stock market collapse. Being thrifty is nothing new. Just ask anyone who lived through an earlier stock market crash, the Great Depression, or an Alaskan who has lived through tough times. Mamie Williams lived in Hoonah in 1944 when a fire destroyed much of the town, and she remembers what her first instinct was.
I started putting food up. I never threw anything away. I tried fish, deer meat, berries, jams, jellies, so we always had food.
Alaskans are known for being independent, and in the old days anyway, self-sufficient. But they were also known for helping out a neighbor in need.
So my friend would send a little note with their children. Mimi, I have a pot of rice on the stove and nothing to go with it. So I'd give them a jar of deer meat or a jar of fish, and I didn't use a quart jar. I used half-gallon jars.
Maybe it's that neighborly instinct that recently had Julia O'Malley driving around to deliver a bag of dog food. When her dog wouldn't eat the kind she bought, she thought of a guy she knows who could use it.
I wind off the glen, around behind a sagging bar, past a storage place hemmed in with hurricane wire, with 30 pounds of dog food in my shotgun seat. For a moment, I think I'm lost, but then I see a ragtag collection of RVs staked out along the highway. C.K. McKellar, a big-mouthed, nearly homeless housing activist, has been calling me up at work going on 2 years now. For about that long, I've been trying to rescue him from a series of derelict fifth wheels he's been hermit crabbing his life in and out of for years. Every month or so, his gravelly voice comes in over the line. "Hello, Wolfpack girl," he says, referencing Nevada college football. I was born in Reno. He spent his career in Vegas tending bar before he retired and moved to Alaska. Then his heart went bad, and he started collecting disability. His checks about cover rent for a real apartment, but that doesn't leave anything left for food. Which is how he ended up a year-round RV man. He could qualify for public housing, but to get priority on the long list, he'd have to go to a shelter and declare himself homeless, which he won't do. And he'd probably have to give up Sophia, his dog, which he won't do either. That brings me to my errand. I inch down a row of RVs until I see a whiskey-colored sled dog nosing out of an open door curtained with a wool blanket. I can tell her tail is wagging even before I see it. As soon as I get out of the car, she nuzzles right into me, her mouth a wide dog smile, pink tongue lolling. "See?" CK pushes a blanket out of the way and comes down after her. "Isn't she a good girl?" CK worked winters as a mall Santa Claus until last year. That's when he shaved his white beard into a long goatee in honor of a homeless buddy who froze to death. Between the facial hair and the earrings, he's too punk rock for the Santa gig, so he sticks to volunteering, cleaning up old homeless camps. When he calls me, it's usually to bark about why no one is taking care of people who don't want to go to the shelters. He's long on ideas, but short on patience for government. I listen for a while, and then we get around to the topic of whether he's got gas money to pick up a food box of his own, and his next appointment to get his heart checked. He's got a surgery coming up. Sometimes he lets on that he's tired of being sick, worried about dying, and what will happen to his dog. I find myself thinking about him later in the day. He scoops up the dog food and invites me in, trailing kibble. It's a messy little lair with enough room for his computer, his television, and some milk crates full of junk. Down the hallway, I glimpse his bed, unmade and comfortable looking, covered with a down comforter. All the windows are covered with blankets. He's repaired the roof from the inside with plywood and spray insulation. Pretty soon, he tells me, he'll get the shower working. Wouldn't you rather live inside a house with walls? I ask. I used to have a big house, he says. I even had gardeners, two of them. But me, I'm like the homeless living over there at Centennial Park. Don't want to be judged, just want to be left alone. He walks me out to the car. Sophia weaves between us, light on her feet. Thanks a lot for the dog food, Wolfpack, he says, shaking my hand. I circle out of the RV park, the cold sunset turning the light golden. I can see CK and Sophia in the mirror. He's still waving. It occurs to me that he is happy, holed up in his little fort, king of fraying plywood and rusty freezers and frizzy tangles of Christmas lights. Maybe I don't need to rescue him. Maybe this is one of those things best left alone.
Julia O'Malley is a reporter for the Anchorage Daily News.
Bottom dollar, this looks like the end. Oh, how I hate to see you go. Bottom dollar, we've been the best of friends. We must have counted on each other 100 times.
Rising costs have made life difficult for plenty of people in urban areas, but in Alaska's rural villages, energy prices tip the scale in many households, prompting a hard decision to move to Alaska's population centers. It's put an unexpected load on Anchorage schools. Earlier this year, it was reported that the city's school district had 500 more students than predicted, many of them making the transition from rural areas. That's where Doreen Brown steps in. She's the supervisor for the district's Indian Education Program. She says the migration has been going on for quite a while.
This has occurred in the last 3 years, so it's not a migration that has had a big boom, but has been going on for the last 3 years. But we have to think about this summer and this past spring when gas prices rose. In Deering, gas was barged in and they were charging $12.50 a gallon.
She says some native corporations have reported a doubling of the number of shareholders now living in Anchorage. Brown says most natives would prefer to stay at home, but sometimes they just can't.
We complained in Anchorage when our gas was $4 a gallon or more. I can't imagine having to pay $12.50 a gallon. So you have to think about the long-term effects of, you know, heating your house, for example, throughout the whole winter and how much that's going to cost. I think that most families do want to stay at home, but economic situations are making them having to move.
Brown says this year's big PFD, combined with the one-time energy rebate, helped some people to decide that this was the year to take the plunge into urban life. And children yanked out of rural schools have a lot of adjusting to do.
I had a student that came from a small rural community outside of Barrow, and when the child came in, the classroom itself had over 25 students in it, a little second grader, and just that classroom itself was very overwhelming. It was a lot louder than the place that she had come from. It was a lot larger. The school is larger, had as many or more students in it than the village had. And then the child had to walk about six city blocks in the dark because the parents were working. Second grader, she never had to walk in the city before, and she didn't know anybody. So just that getting to school was an issue as well. I personally walked that child to and from school for the first 4 days so that we could buddy her up with other kids that were walking.
It's Brown's job to make sure children make the transition. Sometimes she'll arrange home-style lunches for Native kids who are intimidated by cafeteria, noise, and crowding. Across town, a group of first graders, many of them Alaska Natives, are not in the least intimidated as they line up just before heading outdoors to play. Alaska's Native Cultural Charter School is in temporary digs in an Anchorage church, and what might have been a problem for some schools in September has been a boon for the charter school.
Martha Gould Lee is both school president and an elementary teacher in the K through 6th grade school.
And word of mouth has just been really our way of spreading the word that we are here. And we've had ads in the paper and we've been on the radio, but actually our parents that have been here have been so pleased that we just have families coming in, just mostly by word of mouth, I think. And it's been great.
When the charter school's doors opened this fall, there was concern that enrollment would not meet the 150-student minimum, but some new rural students cycling in boosted attendance. Gould Lee says transitioning students are less than half the student body, but they need particular attention.
We understand their nonverbal cues, like when they raise their eyebrows, it's yes. They're saying yes if they raise their eyebrows, or they're saying hello. So our staff knows that. And eye contact was also a big thing. In the Western world, they expect you to look at them. And, of course, teachers need students to look because they're demonstrating so much. So that's something we continually work on with the kids because they are listening. You can tell their head is kind of turned towards you. But their eyes are often down or they're, you know, doing something down here. And that's a cultural thing.
She says Native students in the classroom react at a different pace than do city kids.
One of them said that when they were at their school, the teachers not only talked too fast, but when they would ask a question, she said, I would raise my hand, but before I had a chance to answer even, they would call on another student. So that wait time wasn't being provided.
There's many cultural differences that affect a child's learning ability, and this year is the first in which minority student enrollment in Anchorage schools reached the 50-50 mark.
50% minority, 50% Caucasian.
The migration of Alaska Natives could bring on greater understanding among different cultures in the school system, she says.
It needs to be addressed bluntly, frankly, openly, because this is truly a starting point.
Gould Lee says earlier migrations, not all of them by Natives, have played a huge part in Alaska history.
And so now I'm teaching immigration, the gold rush of 1890. How did that affect Alaska? How did it impact Natives? You know, positive and negative, and that's not in the textbooks. But the general immigration pattern and the gold, was all of that is there, but there's just not the Native perspective.
She says Indigenous knowledge is profound, and the new in-migration could result in a greater sharing of Alaska Native wisdom with the wider population. Coming up later in the show, some tips to stretch your dollars.
The card itself is free. You can use your card to get books.
After the break, we'll check in on retirement funds for Alaska State employees.
What we're doing is sticking to our knitting. We know that our investments are for the long run.
Stay with us. Welcome back to AK. Alaska's salmon hatcheries provide a lot of fish to commercial and sport harvests in the state to the benefit of fishermen. By law, Alaska's hatcheries are nonprofits. Some get funding through a statewide salmon enhancement tax, but the rest rely on grants or loans and the sale of a portion of their run returns every year to keep afloat. In years when the salmon don't return in large numbers, budgets can get pretty tight. That's what happened with the Pinks in Southeast this year. AK's Bonnie Sue Hitchcock traveled to Port Armstrong recently to see how the hatchery there keeps things going.
At one time, Port Armstrong was a whaling station and later a herring packing plant. But today, the 13 residents who live and work here are all focused on salmon and keeping the hatchery operation running.
Everybody here is here to stay, I think. We got a pretty stable crew, which is really neat. Nobody wants to go anywhere. But as far as I'm concerned, it's the best place there is. Lucky to be here.
Ben Contag has been the Port Armstrong hatchery manager for about 3 years.
Once the water passes through there, it goes outside and it goes through a degassing tower, and then it feeds your fish, your raceway, your incubation room, wherever it needs to go. And they always run. They never stop.
Contag explains the hydroelectric power that basically runs Port Armstrong's operation.
I bet it's less than 400 gallons of fuel that we buy for this whole hatchery. That includes fuel for outboards and everything else. That's pretty minimum for a a fairly big place.
Coho that have returned to spawn are swimming around in long metal raceways, all connected like lanes in a swimming pool. They line the boardwalk, and soon the crew will take eggs from these fish to use as brood stock. Contag seems pleased with what's returned.
This coho look real good. Last year we had a few fish died due to fungus, but this year I thought I gave them some salt water in the early stages when they were still somewhat bright. I was pumping salt water in the raceway once a day for 4 or 5 hours, and I think that has helped. We have no mortalities, none.
Contag is talking about a bacterial disease that fish get in the freshwater stage, but doesn't live in salt water. It was introduced when the lakes in the area were stocked with trout.
People treat fish with antibiotics for it, but I don't see it. It's not needed. I don't think it's needed. We got plenty of salt water right a few feet away from the raceway, so I just pump salt water in there for 4 or 5 hours at a time, and that seems to completely stop the problem.
In the next building, Jessica Dath is sorting eggs that will then go into incubation tanks.
I'm picking the bad eggs out of the good eggs here. These white ones, they're dead, and these red ones are alive.
This tanks are called R48, and there are a bunch of pink eggs in there. These are our very last eggs.
Contag has just touched on the hot topic of the season, the dismal returns of pink salmon. It was so bad this year, they had no harvest of returning fish. Selling those normally makes up half of the operating budget.
It's a big part of our income to keep this hatchery going. If you can't harvest any fish, you just don't have any income. Luckily, we had a few cohos that came back, but it's still not enough to pay for our budget by any means, so we're going to have to be very conservative with what we do and try to make the best with what we got and keep going. I'm not going to give up because of one bad year.
But because everyone is so invested in what they do, a low return like this year sets the tone for the entire site. John Thorrington is the maintenance manager in Port Armstrong and the resident with the longest history. He came to the site, newly married, as caretaker in 1982.
And came down with Ken Bellows and 185 with all our worldly belongings. And set up housekeeping, and it was as close to Eden on Earth as you could get. There were just the two of us, newly married, no one else on site.
Thornton's three children were raised for a time at Port Armstrong, but he came and went over the years, struggling with different management styles and changes to the place that he didn't always agree with. But he praises the crew that's here now. And as for the lack of pink returns, Thornton says it's anybody's guess.
I will have to say, and not just in defense of my friends here, but I've been in the business for almost 30 years. I came up in 78. And the quality of the fish that this crew puts out under Ben's oversight are beautiful fish. There's no question. So I truly don't believe there's any culture mistakes. I do believe that we are in times of change from the environmental standpoint.
And that would jibe with what scientists and others are hypothesizing about what's affecting wild pink stocks and this year's returns in general. Contag says that first phase of a fish's life cycle is the most vulnerable.
Most of the fish get eaten right away as soon as you let them go. I mean, rockfish, whales, seagulls, I don't know, other salmon, everybody will eat them. It's a huge ocean. I don't know if any fish get caught in the high seas by drift fishermen. Maybe that's part of the problem, too.
Because hatchery fish are protected in the freshwater phase of development, they're actually less vulnerable than their naturally spawned counterparts. So that makes some scientists think ocean conditions like acidification might be the culprit. Because living and working at the hatchery are so intertwined, residents seem to almost take the low pink salmon returns personally, even though it's beyond their control. Operations manager Sam Raybung says it's the nature of the business.
We have no control of the fish when we let them go, and they have to do well on their own. We can't take care of that. So sometimes we do well, and I say we, I mean the fish, and sometimes we don't.
It's as if, since the crew can't imagine living anywhere else, they can't imagine why the fish wouldn't come home either. For AK, I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Rivers in the clay for my dish, and I thank you, Lord, when I eat my fish.
A lot of people these days are worried about their retirement funds. This year's quarterly financial statements were already showing a gradual decline before October's stock market hemorrhage. State employees, and there are a lot of them, belong to the Public Employees Retirement System, or PERS, which provides retirement benefits to members and their survivors. We called Gary Bader, the chief investment officer for the State Department of Revenue, to find out how the wobbly stock market is affecting PERS retirement incomes. And he says it all depends on when you started working for the state.
3 years ago, the retirement systems had major modifications, and so it's difficult to talk about the retirement systems in a way that will apply to all of them. Most people are members of what is called a defined benefit system. And defined benefit simply means that when a person retires, that the retirement benefit is calculated according to a formula based on their average salary and the number of years of service and so on. Newer employees are now still members of PERS, but their benefit is now called a defined contribution benefit. And a defined contribution means that a certain amount of funds are set aside for that employee each year, and the employee has control over how those funds are invested. So their fortunes in the stock market and bond market are more determined by the employees. When we're talking about public employees' retirement system defined benefit, what happens in the market certainly is unsettling to those people, but their retirement benefit will be based upon the formula and not based upon the returns in the market. So the market could do exceedingly well for a period of time and that would not affect their retirement, or it could do exceedingly poorly and it would not affect their retirement.
So you're saying that if the market tumbles or if the market skyrockets, it really does not have that much of an impact on the amount in people's retirement accounts?
If they're in the defined benefit program, there is an account for them that keeps track of their contributions and a statutory amount that goes to it. But their benefit, if they actually retire from that system, is based on a formula. Those who are in the defined contribution plan, if markets go down and they coincide with their retirement, then it will be a adverse impact on those people.
Do people need to worry? Is this something that, I mean, this huge downturn in our whole financial system, is something that can be overcome in time?
I think in time it can. Large stocks are down about 37-38%. If a person's investments were in large stocks only, remember, when it goes down 37-38, it takes a lot more than that for it to come back to where it started. If you envision if you had $100 in the account and you lost 50% of it, your account would be worth $50 now. In order to get back to 100, you'd need 100% return the following year. So, yes, it will take some clawing out for people who are mostly invested in stocks to do that. Our pension funds, the defined benefit funds, are spread among a number of different asset classes. And yes, we are having a bad year. We're probably down about 19% as we speak. That's not anything that we like seeing happen, but it's a far cry from the 37-38% if we were only in stocks. So yes, when people open their statements, if they are invested in mostly in stocks, it'll take a while to claw their way back. But the idea is that they're also contributing additional monies each year, which will come from a lower starting point. And hopefully, when the markets return, they'll get back not only to where they started, but far ahead. The one message that I would like to see defined benefit people understand is that while we are experiencing some losses in the defined benefit plans, there are billions of dollars still invested, and that are not in any short-term situation where we wouldn't be able to pay benefits. It's where we have billions of dollars left to pay benefits, and people should not anguish about their benefit check coming next month or next year.
Gary Bader is Chief Investment Officer for the state's Department of Revenue. In the village of Nanwalik, preschool-age kids have been part of a language immersion program in their local Supkiak language. But they haven't had their own space. They find room where they can, sometimes in people's houses. As Kathleen Gustafson tells us, they hope a new CD will raise awareness and funds for the program.
The whish, ba maich du gut, bak yoruluta du lagun, de ki niach du gut.
That's Rhoda Moonen. She and her sister Sally Ash have taken the 10-minute plane ride across Kachemak Bay from the village of Nanwalik to Homer. They've come to talk about their work on a CD that they've put together as part of a native language immersion pre-kindergarten program. They're teaching big school readiness in the Supkiak language. The name of the CD is Gwonkada Sukstun Atuttupet Nanwaligami, Our Sukstun Songs in Nanwalik. Rhoda says that she and her sister started to conceive of the project back in the 90s when she was a preschool teacher in Nanwalik.
There's two different worlds that we live in, Sukpeksan, you know, westernized, where we grew up eating our native foods, and those were the things that weren't allowed in that program through that USDA
Head Start
program. Mm-hmm. But thinking, you know, these children are really missing out on their real food, you know, their cultural food. And that's when me and my sister, we started talking a lot about it, and finally I said, I will resign from my job and just to go join the team for the immersion.
With each track on the CD, first the Sukstung lyrics are spoken, and then children from the immersion program sing the songs. Some of the songs are English songs that have been translated, some are original songs written by Nanwalik residents, and Sally Ash explains that some of them are shared songs. Then Rhoda introduces track 13 from the CD.
That's basically Kodiak and the Prince William Sound. We share the same song in different dialect, you know, some of them, not all of them, but we do share the same.
Snostop is his name, is a little louse in the steam bath, too. Taking a bath, and then this little Nosta comes and they splash him with hot water, the rocks, yeah, to make it more hot.
According to Ash, one of the challenges of preserving her language is making sure that it remains alive and growing.
From Fairbanks, Dr. Jeff Flair, who teaches the Aleutic language. With his help, Kodiak got some new words, and like how would you say computer or car, and a lot of our new words are in Russian because the language, little bits of it left behind.
Track 8 on the CD proves that some words can stay the same in every language.
Hokey pokey does not translate into Sukstun. So we call it hokey pokey like everyone else.
The goal in producing the CD is definitely to share the language of Nanwalik, but also to keep the program going. The village is filled with people who are willing and able to share the language and keep Sukstun spoken in the homes.
And all the people, the parents who are trusting to give their children, and they're still, you know, they want to bring them to the school. They keep asking, when are we going to have school? And I tell them, give me space and, you know, we'll do it. So as much as we can, we try to think of capital funding or whatever it's called to build our own school. Although Wally wants to help out, Wally the chief, he wants to help out make a building.
Ash says she remembers going to school and only speaking English, then returning home to speak Sukstun.
Parents, you know, they give us to school and the school taught English, and I am so surprised. I could never get over this. One lady speaking the language of how many kids, maybe 30, everyone learned, you know, and now when it takes more than one to get them to speak our language.
Track 14 of Gwonkada Sukstun Atuttupet Nanwaligami is a song that many people on the Homer side of the bay recognize. It's sung often when Nanwalik residents travel across the bay to Homer to share their culture.
This next song I wrote with my son Sperry. It's about how important unity is and how if we work together, we will become a strong Sukhbek tribe.
In Homer, I'm Kathleen Gustafson.
Right now, the CD is available in Nanwalek. It should also soon be available in bookstores in Homer and elsewhere. After the break, an effort to bring low-cost hydropower to one community turned out to be more than one man bargained for.
My wife gets very nervous about all this, and what's our future? Everything we have is tied up in this business.
You're listening to AK from the Alaska Public Radio Network. I'm Ellen Lockyer, and this week, we're getting thrifty. High fuel prices have rural utility companies across the state looking for ways to save money and ease the burden on their customers. At the mouth of Glacier Bay in Southeast, the community of Gustavus is on the verge of completing a hydroelectric project at nearby Faults Creek. Planning began in the 1980s and has faced challenges since its inception. Faults Creek was part of Glacier Bay National Park, and the project required a land exchange. The area is prime wildlife habitat, and neighboring downstream lands owned by members of the Huna Tlingit tribe have been impacted. Amidst the controversy, the project is expected to produce some 50 years of power. AK's Scott Burton has more.
When Dick Levitt started this project, he didn't know it'd be so controversial.
When I started this, I thought it'd be patted on the back, especially by the environmental community, to get off diesel.
The 64-year-old is the manager and owner of Gustavus Electric.
Some in the environmental community were that way. Others thought I was doing the worst thing that could probably happen to humanity. And there's still people in town here who feel that this was a bad thing to have taken that land out of wilderness.
And out of town, like the Sierra Club and the Huna Tlingit. But Congress and Bill Clinton liked the plan. In 1998, the Glacier Bay Boundary Adjustment Act was signed. Falls Creek, known as a run-of-the-stream project, will take water from an elevated section of the creek, run it downhill through a large pipe or penstock, into a generator, then back into the stream. When the water freezes or gets too low, the pipe is closed. It required a 1.5-mile access road, a 2-mile road that runs along the pipe, an intake station, a generation house, equipment staging areas, a waste area, and gravel pits. The access road was placed in the least productive forest possible and winds around to avoid old trees marbled murrelets might nest in. The used water is placed back in the stream as high in the salmon habitat as they could manage.
Okay, hang on.
Bob Christensen is the project's environmental consultant. Once in the construction phase, his job was to walk in front of the bulldozer that built the road he is trying to drive up and do things like monitor the excavation of a pit that was required for materials.
It's a pretty big hole at this point. Fairly large rock pit, because this rock pit had to serve the entire project area. We didn't want to try to find another one because it just wasn't worth the risk, not knowing what's underneath the ground.
The road itself and places like the rock pit are visual reminders of some of the project's costs, the aesthetic ones, and to wildlife.
Right there, there was a scratch tree, a place where, you know, the bears would stop and they would rub their backs on the tree, they would bite the tree. When that tree was cut down so that a helicopter could land here to drop off the fellers who were, you know, clearing the road right of way, It was crushing to me, because I really appreciate those scratch trees, and to see that thing come down simply just to make room for helicopter access on this particular day, it was really difficult for me. It was a hard day to sort of keep the big picture, you know, in the forefront.
For Peter Turner, the big picture means reducing the possibility of pollution.
Anybody handling fuel anywhere in the world, the potential for a drop, a drip, or a catastrophic spill is very, very high.
Turner is a fisherman, a carpenter, and a boat builder. He's supported the project since the 90s, and in 2007 decided to put his body where his mouth is. Over time, he became construction superintendent for the project. Construction should be completed within 1 year, and it should produce power for 50.
And in that 50-year design life, I calculated that the offset, the reduction in diesel fuel would amount to about 10 million gallons of diesel fuel in 50 years, which is approximately the amount of crude oil, actually 11 million gallons of crude oil was spilled in the Exxon Valdez oil spill of 1989.
But the project's downstream neighbor is more worried about pollution closer to home.
My clinket name is Kachuta, and my other clinket name is Katya. My English name is Thomas Mills Sr., and I'm the caretaker of the property at False Creek and all the other properties that are in the family's holdings over there on Excursion Unit side.
Mills was against the land trade that enabled the project. His family has a cabin at the mouth of the creek, and among other things, he's concerned about drinking water and fish and wildlife habitat.
Well, my feeling said everything that I thought was going to hurt the land has came true.
He says when excavation work was done, dirt and hydraulic fluid got into the creek. But the biggest problem?
And along our property, they created a great big cliff. So we can't go there, and we can't go through the edge for fear of sliding off it.
The cliff was created when crews cut away a hillside to build a road and powerhouse. A tree on top marks the boundary of Mills' property, and it's about to fall over the edge. The Tlingit may sue. The project was designed to have the smallest footprint possible, but over time it's grown. Levitt didn't conduct geotechnical studies before he began digging. He says while it was part of the park, he couldn't. And the clay the construction crews found instead of the rock they were hoping for wasn't easy to work with. The summer of 2006 was one of the rainiest in history, and the terrain and the remoteness of the project caused countless challenges. The project may have no benefits to Thomas Mills' community of Huna across Icy Strait. They won't get any of the hydropower. So the project is easy to oppose. But for Gustavus resident Sean Nielsen, it's a tougher call.
When this whole thing was going through, I found myself struggling with it as a person that is an environmentalist and also as a person that is pro-clean energy and recognizes a fact from a realistic standpoint that we use power and we need to get it from somewhere. Certainly hydro would be a better option than burning diesel from a diesel generator. I'm still torn back and forth because when you really look at this thing from an objective standpoint and consider all the pluses and minuses, all the winners and losers, It's very gray.
It's created jobs, but it's also divided the community. And many hope when it's done, they can move on. Levitt is looking forward to it also.
My wife gets very nervous about all this and what's our future. And she has way more anxiety attacks than I do. Everything we have is tied up in this business.
Between himself, friends, and relatives, Levitt has close to $1 million into the project. The final cost should be $8 million, almost twice the original estimate of $4.2 million in 1999. Levitt still says the power generated will cost about a half to a third less of what it does now. But for many, that rising price tag and the environmental effects raise the question, is it worth it? For AK, I'm Scott Burton.
You're worried about retirement savings. The economy stinks. It might seem like an odd time to think about buying art. But Eugene Salavio, co-owner of the Sitka Rose Art Gallery, says it's actually the perfect time.
Instead of losing it on the stock market, I could have had a beautiful piece of artwork on a wall, so somewhere in a home, and something I can always have. The stocks is just a piece of paper and goes up or down, and a piece of artwork, particularly if it's a real good quality one, is theirs forever.
And at least a handful of Sitkins seem to be taking Salavio's advice. When local artist Steve Laurie had a show recently of some of his most current work, he sold 10 out of 14 paintings that night, including one to AK's Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. She talked to Laurie about putting a price on art.
From a financial point of view, well, you know, let's talk about that. Let's talk about finance.
Okay.
Money. Okay. It's, first of all, it's a difficult thing for me to deal with as a as an artist. I have great trouble with it. I'm not good at marketing myself. I'm not good at coming up with prices for things. These paintings are, I'll be quite frank with you, inexpensive. But to me, and I know to you, that's not true. I can't afford to buy these. I can't go into a gallery and pay for a painting like, I couldn't buy one of these paintings. I haven't got the money, truly. But they are inexpensive. I know they are. Because they're okay paintings. They're successful. I know a good, you know, let's just forget that I'm involved in doing them. We just came in off the street and these are hanging on the wall. I know that that's a strong painting, and I know that that's a strong painting, and I know that that's a, you know, I can go through them and tell you why, and I, or they wouldn't be hanging here. So I'm very comfortable with the prices. That, unfortunately, I mean, I can't spend that on a painting. I'd have to really want it. But for other people, there are other people who have no trouble at all. It's nothing. And from a making a living perspective, I don't make much off of the, you know, off the paintings. It's just the way of the world. It's the way it works. Mm-hmm. You'd have to sell them for more or sell a lot more of them. It would seem reasonable from what Eugene has said and others that people were a little more hesitant to spend this summer, or if they did spend, they spent a little less. But there are always people who none of this stuff affects, who can walk in and buy a $24,000 bronze sculpture, whether times are theoretically bad or times are good. They're always there.
And you sold 10 of your paintings at the opening, and those were to local people.
Yes.
That, you know, I think for many of them, it was a huge purchase.
Exactly.
It was this is the first piece of art I've ever bought.
Yes, exactly. So, Bonnie Sue, that's what blows me away, if you like. I'm not keen on that term, but I have a show, and 10 paintings of 14 sold to people in Sitka. So, yeah, it's very flattering, very, very flattering, and I'm very grateful that they support me, because that's essentially, that's also how I see it. I'm being supported by that, because it allows me to keep painting.
And I think the whole, you know, putting a dollar amount on your work is difficult for a lot of artists.
I believe it.
And, yes. You know, and so now here we are talking about the economy and what this is doing for the galleries, and the galleries need the artists, so there's... Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a symbiotic relationship between us, of course, between the galleries and the artists. As I said earlier, I am not a marketer. Some people are good at marketing themselves, really good, you know, and there are several of them here in town, and they leave me in the dust, and they get more money for their work and all of that, but, well, it's not me. you know, I'll try to, my emotional attachment, I try to leave that behind when I quote-unquote finish a painting.
You do.
You know, no painting's ever finished, because you can always do better, always. I mean, if you don't think that, then for me, that's, you're missing something. If you think you've finally reached that edge where you've been trying to get, well, you're probably going to trip up.
Sitka artist Steve Laurie. To link to his website, head to ours. akradio.org. Okay, we promised you some nifty tips on how to save money around the house. Let's start with the basics, like what to do when the paycheck comes in. I asked my friend Brittany Stark to help us out. She's got a new angle on putting something away for a rainy day.
Yes, my husband and I decided to have two bank accounts, one to pay bills and one for fun money. So that way we never spend any of our bill money on fun things.
So how do you split it up?
My husband's, all of his money goes into one account, and my money goes to another account. And because he makes more than me, we put that into our bill account. And there's always extras, and we just save that for if there's a big expense.
A big expense, like maybe that credit card bill that's built up? You can whittle that down in a blink if you follow good advice from Wendy Romberg, Education Coordinator for Consumer Credit Counseling. She's got a new spin on going cold turkey.
Stop using the credit cards.
You won't hurt the credit cards by putting them in a small tub of water and sticking them in your freezer. That way you still have them if you truly do have an emergency, but you'll have to think about it seriously before getting them out to buy those extra Christmas presents or go out to dinner that extra time.
With your plastic on ice, what to do for fun? Lots of things. You can get music, videos, and more at your local library. And all of it for free.
Let's say during the week, Dad went and purchased an auto repair manual and three movies, and he got a newspaper subscription for a month. It would cost him about $60. Mom goes and gets a real estate exam study guide, a mystery book, and then sister goes and she bought two board books and two movies. Totally, that cost to that family would be $261.52. Well, of course, now if they'd gone to the library for all of those same things, the cost would have been zero.
Karen Keller is director at Anchorage's Lusac Library. She says library cards don't cost a dime, and libraries are a good place to start a job hunt if that's what's needed.
We have computers at all of the libraries. In addition to the workstations that we have there, we offer wireless access at all the libraries, too.
Speaking of job searches, we all need to look our best, and nothing defines a way a person looks more than a good haircut. Can't afford fancy salon prices? Then head straight to the beauty college.
We've been cutting hair for $10 since 1972. We've never increased our prices on our haircuts.
That's Shannon Kelly of Trendsetters in Anchorage. Kelly says even some high-ranking Alaskans dig the $10 haircut.
We do 300 to 400 people a day, usually.
A day?
Mm-hmm. And we do everybody from homeless people to the governor. Just depends on who comes in the door.
The governor was here?
We've done Mr. Murkowski's hair a few times, and the Hinkles. We've done a lot of people.
And while you're getting a new do, get some new, or not really new, but almost new, duds. There's lots of consignment shops around. Debbie LaFlamme co-owns Clothesline Consignment in Anchorage.
Saving money with using consignment stores is two-tiered. You can definitely save money buying things at consignment stores. You can generally guess that you're going to pay about half or less than half of what it would be retail. The other tier being if you have things in your closet that don't fit you, you don't like, bring them in for consignment. You can make some extra money that way. If people consign items and they hold their earnings for in-store credit, you get a 10% discount when you buy things.
How's that for getting more bang for your buck? And one more. Don't forget to use coupons when going shopping. They really do save you money. Rob Clem is owner of the coupon-packed Book of Good Deals.
Most advertisers, the reason they use coupons is to attract new customers because they know, you know, a new customer will keep coming back. So if they'll give you a good price on that to get you through the door once, knowing that you'll be a repeat customer, hopefully.
Clem says food is about the most popular coupon item.
On a family of four, where I've got a real close estimate, people go for the food a lot. Typically, on average, about a third off of your restaurant bill would be typical if someone continued to take advantage of all the coupons throughout the book. That's $100 at least, you know, a month.
Well, at least if you eat out that often. And help support local restaurants in tough times. Clem says one retailer counted 1,400 coupon-bearing customers in his establishment in 1 month. And that's AK for this week. We had help from Julia O'Malley in Anchorage and Kathleen Gustafson in Homer. Our theme music is by Bumua. For more on the other music we use, head to our website, akradio.org, and check out the text rundown on the archives page. You can also check out past shows, look for photos, and send us an email to let us know how we're doing. AK's Scott Burton reported from Gustavus this week, and Bonnie Sue Hitchcock from Point Armstrong and Sitka. Gooseberry Peter is our audio engineer. Our producer is Jessica Cochran, and our editor and executive producer is Duncan Moon. I'm Ellen Lockyer. I hope you'll join us again next week.
Thanks for listening to the podcast version of AK. To listen to the broadcast version or to hear earlier shows from our archives, visit akradio.org. Send feedback about the show to ak@aprn.org. And if you like what you hear, remember to support your local public radio station.